With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Wednesday morning, it's time for our very popular Legal Hub program. Who would have thought a legal program would be so popular? Well, it's turned out to be. So many of you are tuning in this morning to hear our Legal Hub. I want to welcome in, making a return after a few weeks because she's been very busy, Katie Ashby-Coppins. Katie, great to see and hear you again.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's so lovely to be back with you and the listeners this morning. Good morning, everybody.
Thank you. And special guest, Sue Gray. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's great to be here talking.
Nice to have you. Okay. One acronym, NZTSOS. Where do we start there? Not kind of the best news that many were hoping for.
Extremely disappointing for the teachers, for sure. And yet, interestingly, it's a judgment that covers a lot, and some of it's quite good. It's just a bad overall decision, really, from the teacher's perspective and from a lot of other people's perspective.
Mm. How do we want to pull it apart?
Well, yeah. Where do we start? I think from an overview, it's probably good to recognise and put this set the scene of what this case is and was. So last month, the decision on the Defence Force case. That decision on the Defence Force case was specifically in relation to a New Zealand Defence Force issued policy for vaccination, quite different to this case, which is the case that raised questions about the vaccination order that applied to many of the different professions. So originally it pertained to the border workers, then it got extended, I think it was about the 15th of November, to prison workers, healthcare workers and teachers. And so this case really is the case of whether or not the vaccination order that was issued to all of those professions, and incrementally as it was lawful. And this was really appeal against the decision to include teachers as the profession within that order. But my view is, had it been successful, then that decision probably would have pertained to all of the other professions as well. So this is a judicial review, not your ordinary court case where you get to test the evidence. And it really was about the lawfulness of the vaccination order that was issued by the government.
And it turns out to be lawful, does it?
It turns out to be lawful, yeah. They narrowed it down into four very narrow issues for the appeal, and I think that may have been part of the problem. That the first issue was whether the right, under Section 11 of the Bill of Rights, the right to decline, refuse medical treatment is an absolute right or not. And then about the exemption criteria, there are a couple of questions about the exemption criteria, because this was super interesting. This NZ Teachers or the teachers' restrictions and mandates came in straight after our court case for the four aviation security workers. And while we were in court, I believe the Crown thought they were going to lose on exemptions, and that the next day, I think, after court, they came out with that wide exemption, that exemption that let any health practitioner give exemptions, which people thought, well, at least that's great. And then we got our decision for aviation security workers, and within a few days, they'd changed the exemption and they'd taken away the ability for any health practitioner to give an exemption, and it was back to Ashley Bloomfield giving the exemption. So this NZ Teachers case, we're looking at that new exemption criteria and whether that was wide enough to be a proper exemption. And they somehow said it was.
So just what you said there, just explain that just a little one more time. So there was an exemption kind of regime, and then it was changed by the government or someone because they thought they would lose. But once they realized they wouldn't, they tightened it up again. Is that what you were telling me?
Yeah, there was a very narrow exemption regime at the start. And then when we were in court in the four aviation security workers case, they thought they were going to lose. And within, I think, the next day, they gave us that broader exemption regime that, yeah. that let anybody give an exemption. And for about 10 days, people were queuing to get exemptions. And then we lost to the four aviation security workers, very similar sort of arguments actually to this NZ Teachers case on the Bill of Rights. We lost it, and within days, the exemptions were narrowed again.
It sounds like playing games to me.
It felt like it too.
Yeah, I remember at the time it was absolutely heart-wrenching. Here we were, giving webinars and advice on this availability of the Section 7 exemption, I think it was, which was a broad exemption that allowed any medical practitioner to grant a exemption to anybody where it was unsuitable for them to receive a vaccine. So really broad ranging. And I think that wording had actually been around in Section 7 of when, as early as when the border workers were able to be vaccinated. But then there was some suggestion that this was this process was being abused. And I think it was the Medical Council, so that apparently arced up and mentioned to the court that, sorry, to the government that this exemption process was being misused. And then we saw the removal of that provision entirely. And then this new process that came in, which allowed only exemptions to be granted by Dr. Bloomfield when it came to medical exemptions. And I remember at the time, I think it took about 2 weeks to get the gazetted criteria through as to what would satisfy a medical exemption. And in the meantime, we had this absolute rush and insane response of, what do people do in this situation where they're looking for an exemption, there's timeframes, you don't know what criteria that there is. And then we just had this rolling snowball of this gazetted criteria where, a previous infection of COVID didn't count and then it did count. And it just kept changing over and over again and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But, it wasn't available instantly. And it was, again, a real knee-jerk reaction to a situation where we were getting amendments to legislation on a dime or on a whim, not properly negotiated or debated in Parliament, and then also options ripped out from under people's feet, just on the precipice of them, thinking that they were able to continue in their employment.
Cruel, so cruel.
Yeah, it was. It's unparliamentary behaviour.
And also we were getting the minister making orders, so it wasn't even going through Parliament.
Which minister are we talking about?
The Minister of COVID Response.
Christopher Hipkins.
Christopher Hipkins, generally. Sometimes there was a new order every day. Like, they literally changed.
Sorry, he's just a student activist from Upper Hutt. What does he know about this?
Yeah.
I mean, question.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I could never understand why we had a Minister of COVID Response. And then I realised that it was a way of the Prime Minister being able to control what the Minister did, because he wasn't bound by the Health Act and all of the health bureaucrats that would be giving him health advice. He was bound by the spin coming down from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet.
So that was a setup.
It was a manipulation of the roles and the introduction of a new office to allow the COVID response to occur as it did.
So,
and to bypass everything else, all the normal requirements.
To change exemption from your doctor to the Director General of Health, I mean, he couldn't probably take in more than one or two a day, could he?
Oh, well, go Sue.
It allowed him to stall people a lot, that's for sure. But the other thing is, how can you make a medical decision when you're sitting in an office in Wellington? And how and why should a bureaucrat's medical decision override the relationship between a doctor and patient that can actually take into account the whole history of
Has
the
he
patient?
Has he ever been a GP?
He was he trained as a doctor, but my research was that he only worked a very short time in the health industry before he got into the administration side.
So like a sportsman that never quite made the team.
Yeah. Becomes a referee.
And like, I think that's really important just for context as well, is you have a doctor-patient relationship. There's actually a special privilege that's identified in a doctor-patient relationship, like there is in your client-lawyer relationship, and even in your with your priest and, you know, someone that attends church. You've got these special privileges because you've got a special relationship with that person, and that privilege is protected in the way that information given in those circumstances isn't able to be shared with other people.
Because it involves your body.
Well, it's a special privilege that's identified as a consequence of that relationship. Yep. And here we've got an entire breakdown of that relationship because you're essentially inserting a politician into your doctor-patient relationship to make a decision as to whether or not your heart attacks that you've suffered for the last, 10 years, are such that, you know, there is a real risk if you have this vaccine that you might suffer myocarditis and pericarditis, which on top of your heart condition might not be ideal. No, that doctor making that decision on your behalf was taken away from your doctor and granted to a politician. And that's where this makes the entire exemption process really problematic, and it really, you know, doctors have had the, you know, wool pulled over their eyes, but they've also had the rug pulled out from underneath them, and they haven't had the chance to behave like doctors, but they also haven't stood up for themselves to ensure that that is able to happen, and they've allowed politicians to insert themselves into the what I would consider to be one of the cornerstone relationships that we have in our communities.
Did you say the medical council advised the government to, that what was the word, that this process was being abused? Is that the word that was used, or taken advantage of something? Is that, they aren't they supposed to look after the doctors or represent the doctors? Or, but here they are, like some call it a sort of classroom telltale.
Exactly what it was like. I've actually defended some nurses who gave exemptions and who got into trouble for giving exemptions because the nursing council said that it was outside their scope of practice. Now, tell me, you've got, we ended up reading through the risks from the Pfizer vaccine, including all of the anxiety and mental health risks and the risk of death from myocarditis, and saying, why is that not a mental health issue, that a mental health nurse cannot make assist a patient to make their decision and get an exemption? But no, the nursing council, the medical council, the midwifery council, all of those councils, they were the ones that actually came up with rules for their own people that literally cut the legs off of them, cut away their fiduciary obligations to their patient, cut away informed consent, and did all of the things that we always thought that doctors were there for.
Okay, so to the teachers, what does that decision mean then?
Yeah, so for the teachers, it's really disappointing to not win the appeal. It in some ways, it doesn't mean too much because the mandate for the teachers was only actually in force in a few months. And the harm that it did, and they actually note that in the decision, the harm and the disruption that the mandate caused for really no gain, you'd have to say, because if you were going to get COVID, you got COVID. And if you're going to get vaxxed, you probably got vaxxed. But the good teachers that lost their careers and lost their relationships, their work, their homes and all sorts of things because of a few months of a mandate, that's the part that I think is going to take a really long time for people to heal. It was also futile. It was so painful.
Hipkins the Minister of Education at this time as well? Do we know? Okay. Because if he was, that would be a huge conflict of interest then, wouldn't it? Because there'd be no one lobbying on behalf of the education bureaucracy or system, you know, pushing back.
You didn't get very far lobbying at this time, Paul.
I suppose, yes.
Remember that censorship?
But again, it just shows you how all in everything is, you know?
And and the unions. I've done some other cases, and the unions got closed down, and they actually lied to the employees about the position of the unions. Some of the unions were actually quite concerned about these mandates, but the government and the employers were telling everybody that, oh, the unions have no issue. So it was just like everything else. Anybody who spoke out got questioned, got name called, got bullied, and in the end they just gave up. And it was only a few brave souls that were left standing, really.
So what were the actual points of law then that it was decided on? Did you mention three?
So the first one, they decided that the right to decline medical treatment is not an absolute right. And I think that's probably...
How could it not be?
Well, in terms of informed consent, it should be, but in terms of the Bill of Rights, and they did trace back the Geoffrey Palmer's background and how it came to be, and I can at least see the logic in that. Where I have a real issue with it is that the courts don't seem to want us to argue, or the government don't want us to argue, that this wasn't just an established medical treatment. This was a novel experimental medical treatment that could kill you, or it could cause permanent harm. And they don't seem to have looked at that, which I think is a really, really important point. We tried to argue that in the Four Aviation Security Workers case, and there's just one paragraph in the decision, the judge is saying, no, it's not an experimental treatment.
Well, how could you say that?
Well, I don't know. He did, though, and that seems to have closed down that argument. But actually, that argument, I believe, especially when it had only provisional consent, is a really live argument that is definitely a winnable argument.
Mm. I still don't get it, because these people are learned, smart people, right? They've spent years in the law, and they're there because of that, and they don't get something that obvious and simple and right in front of their face.
Well, let's put that into context, Paul. You've got one judge. They're not going to make a decision readily against the government. This is a judicial review case. It's not a case where you get to cross-examine the experts. They take much of what the government's experts say at face value. So, for example, in this case, they're acknowledged that they take on face value that the vaccine, albeit for the Wuhan and Alpha strain, was going to be, you know, suitable for the Delta strain, which was in circulation then. You know, they take everything at face value. There's a section which they talk about, you know, this drug is a new drug, unknown safety, long-term safety, but, you know, 10 billion people have been injected with it in X number of countries, so it's got to be safe. And so you've got these complete contradicting terms in just from one paragraph to the next, and you're thinking to yourself, goodness gracious, this, you know, judge, does he know if he's Arthur or Martha? So there, when Sue said before that there's actually some really good commentary in this judgment, albeit the outcome is not one that we would like to see, the comments, I think, are particularly useful.
Well, what are they? What are those comments then?
So I took away from this, and just I'll just wax lyrical a little bit here, that the vaccine wasn't going to work for Omicron, that the no long-term safety data was known, that the health risks associated with the administration weren't known, that there's no long-term safety data and is likely that full extent of potential downstream risks are not yet known, and that such risks may exist is not seriously contested, only potential extent of them. What other things that they were my key takeaways?
Yeah, so, I liked the paragraph at the end about costs. And they actually refused costs even to the government, even though the government theoretically won the case. And the Court of Appeals said there was and remains considerable public interest in the issues raised in this appeal, particularly where the limitations on fundamental constitutional rights protected concepts of personal autonomy, bodily integrity and dignity were justifiably interfered with for the greater good. These are difficult questions upon which there is legitimate public debate.
Ooh.
So Finally, after all the years that we've been caned for trying to have these conversations, the Court of Appeals agreed that there are important questions that people need to talk about. So I think that's quite a positive out of all this. You know, when you lose your human rights, what does it mean? What are the circumstances? What are the alternatives? We need to have these conversations as a community, not just some bureaucrat sitting in Wellington writing some new restriction or mandate overnight and pumping it all out on everybody.
Well, I guess we can have those conversations. We're kind of having one now, but there has to be more than this.
Oh, look, there absolutely does. And this is where the judge is in a pickle. How can they make a decision against a government order, which hails from legislation? You know, they're not going to have a job for very long as a judge. And this is where it really comes down to our House of Representatives, which are the representatives of us, making sure that either the Bill of Rights is empowered more, or alternatively making legislation that this kind of thing can't happen again in the future. And that's really important. We can see in the coalition agreement between NZ First and National that all mandates are to end. We've got an issue that vaccine mandates are still hanging around. And, you know, that's because something else needs to be done. It needs to be done at parliamentary level, and something needs to be done to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Mm. It needs to be done at parliamentary level, but it also needs to be a significant change in culture, the culture of bureaucrats. But why can't we have public servants again? Why can't we have people that actually look after the interests of the public and respect the law and do all the things that they're supposed to do?
You just mentioned, Katie, before the judge, you know, he makes a bum decision, probably won't have a job for long kind of thing. Is that where they're all coming from? Because, you know, they say follow the money, and the point you just made, Sue, yeah, whatever happened to public service? Are these people so greedy and worried about their material well-being that they'll do anything for the money?
No, I think that that's kind of lost a little bit. As a judge, you're not paid an awful lot. I honestly believe that each judge comes
to... status. This is New Zealand,
sure,
but a status.
Not just status, but, you know, you go into law with the best intents of upholding the rule of law and, you know, doing things for the greater good. I honestly believe that. That's certainly why I went into the law. I think that the nuance is that it is very hard for a judge to make a decision that finds against government-created legislation. And that, you know, it might be quite unfair saying, you know, he won't have a job for very long, but he's in a predicament that he can't make a finding against the legislation. He really is. He's not got an option. So he takes the evidence of the government at face value. We don't have cross-examination in judicial review cases like this. It's evidence on the papers. The application to cross-examine the Crown's witnesses was refused. And so we don't get the evidence tested. So it is only taken at face value. And that's
refused?
Very convenient.
Why is that refused?
It's not usual in judicial reviews to be able to cross-examine the other side. And that's because of the type of application. It's a public law application. It's administrative. It's questioning whether or not decisions made at government level are wrong. And there's limited areas in which they can be considered as wrong. And, you know, Wensbury unreasonableness is one of the tests, and, you know, not following due process is another. So it's just a very different nature of a case where, you know, I go into a contract with you, Paul, you breach that contract, and then I sue you, you know, more in a private law capacity. It's just different. So the evidence is not tested, and it means that they can, you know, defer to the government evidence, which sounds a lot better in their view and fits the narrative.
Well, to me, someone, like I say, dumb guy on the street, just sounds like the system really just doesn't work, actually.
The system is definitely not there for the people. Like, I still don't understand why governments and public bodies get way more protection than we get from each other. So I did a case against the Wool Board years ago, and the court decided that you can't sue. Like, wool growers, they employ the Wool Board to promote their products, but they can't sue them if they do a bad job. So if the CEO of the wall board crashes into you in his car, he's probably negligent and you can probably claim against him. But if he completely lets down the wool industry, none of the wool growers can do anything. And it's not just the wool board, it's the medical council, it's all of these different boards. And it's really the way the system's set up. I mean, I asked myself how it ever got to that. And I wonder if it's anything to do with the power the insurance companies have, or the fact that the judges are recruited often from a sort of corporate background rather than from a sort of public interest background. Definitely agree with Katie. There's a lot of peer pressure on judges. I mean, if you're a judge, you probably can't go out and be mates with most people. You tend to have to hang out with other judges. And so they do a fair bit of sort of judge think, I believe.
Yeah.
We had that issue with a judge, must have been a year or two ago now. He made some quite strong findings against somebody when the lawyer said, look, my client's been mandated out of his work. He can't afford to pay a fine. And the judge said, basically, well, don't come to my court with that kind of excuse. If you're going to let down the public, it's your bad luck. And that resulted in a judicial complaint. And the judge's explanation was that, well, all my fellow judges thought the same thing.
Okay, because there is a feeling through this whole process of the chats we've had here and people we've interviewed and all of that, just the general impression is that we are kind of up against institutions that are not on our side. We can't rely on like we thought we could. It's like, it's not fair, right?
No, and I think that's, this decision of the teacher's case is not surprising to me. Really not surprising. And that's because of, some of the points that we've touched on here. But ordinarily, we should have what's called a separation of powers. The judiciary is separate from the government, albeit that is a concept that I don't know actually exists in practice. And that's because of all those things, judges hanging out with each other, not being able to make decisions, starting at the decision they want and working backwards to fill in the background behind that. We see that a lot with the decisions. And look, this is a really, really tough time. And I think that the situation is if the judges don't want to hear the opposing evidence or the evidence which really makes and pulls into question or calls into question a lot of the decisions, their hands are in their air and they're singing la 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 very, very loudly. And we see that a lot. It's not just in these cases. I've seen it before in other cases. One particular case I was involved in was one where a cool store intentionally changed its gas from Fearon to odorless LPG, didn't tell the fire department. Lo and behold, the fire department needed to respond to an alarm one day, and one of the firemen got killed.
They didn't know what they did.
Seriously injured because they weren't told. And the thing was, is the coroner expressly excluded from the trial any evidence about the change of Fearon gas to LPG.
That would seem to be
that is an inconvenience truth.
Crikey.
It's the thing that killed him.
Man.
But we don't want to talk about it.
Oh, dear.
And the inconvenient truth is the problem over and over again. I've been helping Rory Nairn's parents with the part two of the coroner's inquiry, waiting for the decision on informed consent. And we've been writing submissions and waiting and sending emails and reminding them. And it's gone on for I don't know how many months. It might even be years now. It's super important because informed consent protects everybody. The coroner and the Health and Disability Commissioner are supposed to be standing up for informed consent. And yet they're
so where are they, Sue?
They're sitting on a decision. They've made the decision. They've given us a provisional decision. They've reviewed it. They're sitting on it and they're sitting on it. And a month later, they're still sitting on it. And how many people are getting jabbed without informed consent and suffering injury in the meantime?
And where's the respect for the family?
Yeah. Oh, they apologise.
That's nice of them.
Still waiting. They do apologise. We understand how stressful the delay is, and that's what we get over and over again. It's unbelievable.
So, are there any options for teachers NZTSOS in this now?
There's always a chance of appeal. You need leave to go to the Supreme Court, though. So whether they would get it, they'd have to have a really good argument, grounds.
Otherwise, too bad. Suck it up.
Yeah, look, I think there might be a ground of appeal. But again, leave to appeal, you need to jump through a fair few hoops. And I think that's probably a lot of exhausted teachers that are sitting behind this action.
What would have happened if they'd won?
Oh, I think the ramifications would have been huge. I think that we would have had a very large class action open to all of those that were dismissed as a consequence of refusing to be vaccinated, and all losses are flowing from that. That's a huge imposition on the government. When you consider, even though the mandates were lifted, teachers were still refused to return to work because, they'd shown themselves to be, not of good employee character because they've refused vaccination. So that a lot of them haven't been able to get back to work even after the mandates lifted. All of those that were on long-term service leave, shortly due, all of that falls away. That would have all been claimable had, there been a finding that the vaccination order that affected all of those different workforces was unlawful. Huge ramifications.
Yeah, although they still do have employment claims. I mean, I acted for the aviation security workers and they put us through a lot of hoops and hurdles, but I'm probably not allowed to say too much, but, it was worth the process in the end. Mm. Even though we lost in the High Court, the employment issues were a bit different. And there are issues, for example, they could have found them some alternative occupation in the intervening time. That they just didn't want to, because they were getting instructions from the government that you've got to put pressure on everybody to be vaccinated. We don't want exemptions. We don't want, you've got to set a benchmark here and make it happen. So you can't be kind. You can't be compassionate. Don't worry about these people's careers and their lives.
They weren't giving up their careers, were they? They weren't giving up their careers or their lives, were they? The people imposing this on people, they weren't giving anything up.
It was.
They probably got vaccinated.
Yeah, but still, it was all right for them.
This is the other problem, that the people that are still in the system are the obedient ones that got vaccinated. So they're now, you can assume, the judges, the people running the medical council, the people running the government, are all the ones that went down that path. And so it's really difficult to get a balanced tribunal or get balance out of the decision makers.
Okay. Do you think, we're up against time, do you think there's any institutional vindictive projection going on here? You just mentioned all those people who did that. That's the group. The group think at the mm-hmm. time said horrible things about people who didn't make that choice. And there seemed to be a kind of vindictive streak that came in sort of after this, that people had to pay for what they did or what they thought. Mm. Is that infused in the institutions, do you think? Is there any bit of that?
My feeling is it's infused in humanity. It's not often that you have a judge deciding on a matter that they were affected by as well. So they're able to be a lot more, say, objective. We've got a situation where we all had to do things for the greater good. We were all subjected to that messaging. We were all locked down for 2 years. I think that the judges were like, well, I did it and I'm fine, so you can just do it.
Yeah, but two district court judges died 2 weeks ago in 1 week.
I think it was three.
Oh, three, okay. I missed one.
And look, I'm not sure of their situation. Certainly one of the judges was a friend's dad, and he was in his 70s. So that's the only thing I know about.
I'm not that far
so I can't comment. Hmm. I think that there is, it's not just an issue that impacted judges either. Everybody kind of came away with the attitude, well, I did it, and so you just have to get it on and do it as well. And so that's, I think, not necessarily the vindictiveness of making decisions the way that they have been made, but, you know, a sort of blasé attitude about, you know, well, we all had to do it. We were all doing it for the greater good, and jumping on board with that messaging. I think that that might be the nuance.
Someone told me once, we shielded you. Never forget that, I was told.
And yet they'll never go back and question. What's actually proven now is that it didn't stop infection, it didn't stop transmission, and it was never designed to do that in the first place. So the whole assumption that this whole stack of cards was built on was completely flawed from the start. And yet that's another issue that we're really struggling to get discussed anywhere.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's a block wall that goes up instantly with any opposing evidence.
Anything more to say about this before we end this week's Legal Hub at RCR?
Look, I think it's a very unfortunate decision for the teachers. There are some, and all the other professions that were mandated under that vaccination order. It is something for Parliament to change so that it doesn't happen again in the future. So New Zealand First National, you've signed a coalition agreement saying end to vaccine mandates. Well, I think you need to go one step further and ensure that legislation comes in that means that they can't happen again in the future. Alas, I don't think that they will do that. And so it really is going to come down to the court of public opinion and the power of the people to actually stand up to these things in the future. You know, we all need to be working together here, because being dictated to and told how we've got to live, what we've got to do, and medical procedures that we have to take or aren't allowed, is something where we're very much heading.
Yeah. And the thing about human rights is you don't really need them when life's great. You need them when the going's tough. But if they're not there for us when we need them, when the issues are really hard, then they really are worthless to us. So as Katie said, we've definitely got to do something to strengthen these fundamental rights. And I think a lot of it is educating, getting people actually talking about it and thinking about these things. You know, they've been talking about changing the constitution for years and everyone's like, oh, it's boring. But actually it's not boring. It's super important.
Yeah, good point. Sue Gray and Katie Ashby-Coppins, thanks for being on our Legal Hub this week. Fascinating as always.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. Thanks, Paul. It's been a pleasure to be on this morning. Thank you.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.